the really good news about this is that I had a loving family who took me out of that environment. I had the opportunities through education to engage in a new life. And I was able to kind of exceed expectations in terms of my mortality. I was told I would be dead by the age of 16.
Hi, I'm Brooke Milhouse. Welcome to Disabled and Proud, the podcast that does exactly what it says on the tin. Each week, the show highlights an awesome disabled guest speaking about their own disability, why they're proud to be disabled, and why they're proud to be themselves.
Jason, welcome to Disabled and Proud. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. A bit knackered as usual, but because I'm incredibly busy, which I'll talk to you about a little bit. But yeah, I'm very honoured to be asked, and thank you for asking me. To come on. So yeah.
Oh no, I'm so looking forward to it. I think there's going to be. Like, I say this all the time, and people must be so bored of it. But I learn something new every single episode that I do, and I love that. And there's so much to be said of being able to share knowledge. I think it's a really beautiful part of life. So I'm genuinely really looking forward to this. Now, the first question that I ask everybody on this podcast is, how do you refer to your disability?
A disability. I say I'm disabled. I was in America and I was being called handicapped, which, you know, I found really weird because you know all about the handicapped, the term, where it came from, cap in hand, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. But disability, I've never had a problem because it. If I'm describing myself professionally, I'll say I'm an artist with a disability. Because
yeah.
I'm not a my art's not disabled. My art's very liberated and stuff. But I became disabled as well in 1980, which was apparent. Mm-hmm. I was told as well that it was the best year to become disabled because it was the International Year of Disability, and it was shocking. Mm-hmm. Things were really bad then. But Ian Drury was in the charts with Spasticus Autisticus, so there was like this real sort of rebellious thing happening with the mm-hmm. disability activism movement, which is part of my DNA. So, but coming back to your first question, I am disabled and very proud.
Yeah. I think that is, like, acquiring a disability is so different to being born with a disability. Like, the two are so, they're such a separate experience, and it's so difficult when, so for I was born disabled, so I don't know any different. But if you acquire a disability, like, your life literally turns on a knife edge, and there's no, not that there's no going back, but, like, you become a different person because you have to adapt and you have to change, like, your lifestyle and the way that your body works changes, and loads of different things that you didn't think about before are suddenly brought to the forefront of your mind. And what was that experience like for you?
Really difficult. I mean, so difficult, in fact, that I'm making art about it, you know, 40 years after the event with my latest exhibition at the Welcome Collection. I came from... a very staunchly working class family in Wakefield. We lived on a council estate. I was the baby of eight, so I was meal times were crazy. They were like, you know, a war of attrition. Try get your food. And I was incredibly sporty. Up to the age of 11, I was being watched by talent scouts for rugby because I was captain of my rugby team and all that kind of stuff. But I also was incredibly creative as well. I had this and mum and dad, bless them, they never said, oh, you're working class, we don't go on to be artists or whatever. They were always very encouraging, and nothing was ever impossible or whatever. But I got chicken pox in April 1980, just like every other kid does. But I got them really bad, and they attacked my central nervous system. And I was in hospital for a year because I was completely paralyzed from my neck down. So, and I was like that for 5 years. So this is like, you know, this is great that I can move and stuff. I mean, I'm in a wheelchair and, you know, whatever, but I was, you know, I depended on round-the-clock care. So I went from being really physical and having I mean, the weird thing is, at 11, I was as tall as I am now. So I stopped growing, you know. So I would have been, I mean, I was a tall kid, thankfully. So, you know, I would have been over 6 foot. So, you know, I often imagine what the other me went on to do. My mum and dad had to move like 10 miles to go to a specially built bungalow. I was in hospital for a year and told that I wouldn't make it 16. So, and I was going through puberty as well, which apparently is quite tough, but I missed it out because I was paralyzed. And so there's all these stuff going on. And like, especially that formative age where, I mean, like, you know, any other young lad, I was interested in girls and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was happening out of the window, and I thought, blimey, all my mates were kind of running off and, you know, having their first romances and stuff. And I'm in a hospital bed. I thought, blimey, what's the deal here? I went to a special school as well that didn't bother with sex education because why bother? Because none of us are going to have relationships. And most of you are going to drop dead anyway. So, what's the point, you know? There's all those things, but what I always say when I became disabled, it was a transformative experience. So a very working class background, like I said, not much money, but I was introduced to education in a big way. So and creating art and being creative, and I went like sort of, I read every book. I devoured Dickens and, you know, Thomas Hardy, and I was reading Marx at 16. I was sort of really, really engaged with, you know, expanding my mind, because that's the only bit of me that was kind of liberated. And I always tell this story. When I was 13, we had an IQ test. All disabled kids in special schools had an IQ test. And it came, surprise, surprise, I was okay. And the psychologist said to me, "Mum, he's so intelligent, he could even get married."
My gosh.
Yeah. And I was like, never mind getting married. Where are the girls now? I was like, what about this bit now? Never mind that. But that was the aspiration, that you could be kind of cared for or whatever. And but mum and dad were like really amazing people. And they had to really fight for me not to be put in a home, because in the 80s, the authorities were obsessed about putting people in homes and, you know, not listening to you. And, you know, and mum said, no, he's not going in a home. He's my lad. He's going to stay at home with us, you know. However hard it is, he's staying at home. And bless him, because I still believe that's what kept me alive, really, because of that love and nurturing.
It's really wild for me to hear about disability in your childhood, because the idea that someone would say that today is like atrocious. Like, that would not be the first thing anybody would say about an IQ test, particularly when we're thinking about special schools. And the fact that it was said out loud is so shocking, but actually it's quite a good reminder that wasn't that long ago. And actually we have come so far when it comes to like how we treat disability and how we look at disability. I mean, we wouldn't have had this conversation in the 80s like this, or if we did, it would have been very underground, not spoken about, not shared between two people, very, very secret. So the fact that we can even have this conversation and talk about disability so openly is amazing. But then it also reminds me that there's still such a long way to go, but we have come such a long way in that period of time, which is something that actually I think sometimes we need to sit down and really applaud, because we aren't in the 80s anymore, which is amazing. Like, technology's moved, we've all moved, the way that we view disability has moved, but we still need to remember that happened, because it's not that far away from happening again.
Oh yeah, the warehouses, as they've been sort of nicknamed for disabled people, getting us back in homes. I mean, governments, we are not the problem. We are not the problem. And I tell you what, if we were treated with the humanity that we deserve, you know, mm-hmm. Governments would get so much back, because guess what? We spend money. There's a study that if a disabled person is kept in work and all that kind of stuff, they will spend like £1,000 more per, you know, quarter or whatever than mm-hmm. an able-bodied counterpart, because we do the fact is we do have to spend more money anyway, because mm-hmm. like if I, for instance, and this is so ridiculous, but if I find a pair of trousers that works, I'll buy like 5 pairs, because I'm sat down all the time and I want something that I'm sort of comfortable in. It's the same with shoes, it's the same with, and you can then take that out to transport and an accessible holidays, crikey, it's I'm sure they add a note on if they put the word accessible, you know, mm-hmm. and it's everything is so expensive, but we will spend it because guess what, we want to be like everybody else, we want to be, you know, having relationships and being dads, being mums, you know, whatever. It's about equality.
Mm-hmm. And that's so true, that actually we disabled people, like the purple pound has so much weight behind it. And when you look at brands that have really onboarded their like disabled community, they absolutely thrive, because the disability community know that like whatever brand has their back. And that, like, even for me, I know for a fact that if a clothing store doesn't use disabled models, I won't go near it. But if I see someone who looks exactly like me, I'm like, oh my goodness, the clothes could look like a bag of crap on me, but I would still buy because I'm like, I can see myself there. And that's so right. We do spend more because we have to, but also we're really loyal customers, like super loyal customers. And like, that would be, people need to get on board with realizing this a lot quicker than they do.
I mean, although I'm the opposite, if I see a store that has mannequins that look like me, I keep away from it, but because it's usually an old man shop. But Uncle Albert specializes in Uncle Albert fashion from Only Fools and Horses, but I went grey very early. I'm younger than I look, but I think it's because I'm having a suit made for one of my exhibitions coming up, and mm-hmm. it's the best experience ever, because like I want to look really cool, and you know I mean the wheelchair that surrounds it is kind of a bit of an issue, because it's like going I'm wearing this really posh bespoke suit. And then I've got like the equivalent of Wellington boots in the form of a wheelchair that's like, you know, because I wish there was a way that, and I am actually looking at designing my own wheelchair that would be a bit like Grayson Perry's boob motorbike. He's got a motorbike with boobs and stuff. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll do the same. I'll do something really sort of, you know, out there and challenging, because wheelchairs they haven't really caught up with that, really, that wheelchairs can be funky, and you know, like although a middle-aged bloke shouldn't be saying the word funky, I would be I would be hunted down by youth.
I don't think so. I think you're cool enough to pull it off for sure. Really interestingly, you said earlier that your art and like your work but you're still creating pieces of artwork around about the time that you acquired your disability. And I was wondering, how has becoming disabled and acquiring your disability like really impacted your work and what you do?
It changed everything. I see it as, because my exhibition at the Welcome Collection, which opens at the end of March, is called Jason and the Adventure of 254. Now, when I was diagnosed on the 1st of August 1980, between 3:30 and 3:30, there was the Moscow Olympics on the TV. At the end of my bed was a TV. So the doctor, my consultant, was giving the bad news to mum and dad. And I was watching Sebastian Coe and Steve Ovett in the 1500 meter men's final. at the Moscow Olympics. And on Sebastian Coe, who won the race, had the number on his shirt, 254, which we think is the 10-minute window, 250, when I was actually diagnosed. So this like huge kind of, how is that for the stars lining up? So I've created, I've recreated the hospital ward, but you wouldn't recognize it as a hospital ward because it has a 5-meter sculpture of a version of me in the hospital bed. You can see inside the body, and you can see a bits of like the kind of how the body works, and there's a thing that shows you how the nervous system works and stuff, and you get some other surprises. There's some dioramas all way around that are in these boxes that have memories of childhood, and because it's all about the interior. There's a sculpture of Sebastian Coe at the end of the bed. You won't recognise that it's Sebastian Coe because he has a huge TV for a head, and he has it's like nothing you'd ever see, but it's about being diagnosed, but it's also about the opportunities that were afforded to me as a young working class lad because of my disability. Suddenly, this door opened, and I see it as like my it was the end of one life, but it was like me being born into another. So that education and the, creativity were kind of a real option, because I wasn't going to go work down the mine. I wasn't going to go play rugby professionally. I wasn't going to do any of those things. So I kind of went, down this other path. And the exhibition is all about that. And I'd been making art about that moment in time because I was in bed for, basically a year, and then throughout my teenage years. So it was a huge thing. And all I will say, I mean, that I firmly believe that I was kind of suffering from, a form of PTSD as a result of it as well, because all I will say about that time is people were looked after very differently. That's all I want to say about that. And, but the really good news about this is that I had a loving family who took me out of that environment. I had the opportunities through education to engage in a new life, and be and fly, And I was able to kind of exceed expectations in terms of my mortality. I was told I would be dead by the age of 16. Hello. So, I'm a 54-year-old geezer sort of getting ready to kind of live the rest of my life and go on more adventures and challenge expectations.
And I think that's so important, to challenge your expectations, particularly around disability. And I was actually having a conversation with someone the other day that said something along the lines of, with disability, you kind of have to really know your boundaries quite quickly. And it's not necessarily about stepping outside those boundaries, but it's being able to grow and expand, but also still having those boundaries intact, because it's so important for disabled people to have their boundaries intact, because so often lines are crossed and there's medical negligence, and people ask questions, and like people will touch your chair, or, there's so many boundaries that people cross and they don't realize how important they are. But actually, it's still so important to be able to push those boundaries, because like if you don't, you don't grow, and if you don't grow, then you're stagnant. And I'm not a big believer of being stagnant. I think being stagnant is one of the worst things in the world. But there's so much to be said from creating art, particularly from pain points in our life. And I think that it's really laudable for you to almost put that on display, because even though it might not look exactly how it was, it's not like it's realism, but to be able to explain that in a different way and move through it in a different manner, I think must be quite cathartic.
Well, you said something interesting earlier on about there's a difference between being born with a disability and then becoming disabled in later life. I'd go one further. I was born as an artist. I was, that's what I was created to be. I just didn't know it. I just didn't know it at the time, but I was a really weird kid. I used to talk to my mates about whether they saw blue, asking people in the playground.
All right. Are you Eve Klein?
Yeah. And it's like, and thinking, is this like normal? Are people seeing what I'm seeing? There's all this kind of visual stuff. And, I could only ever make art. That's who I am. And my art is kind of, you know, even I look at it and think, bloody hell, that's weird. Where did that come from? And then I look at a photograph of me in the 1970s and I look at the wallpaper and I go, oh, that's where it came from. You know, all these explosions of color and wearing trousers that were brown and purple. With an orange shirt, with an orange shirt, that's what I was rocking in the 70s. So it's all that stuff. It's watching telly, and telly in the 1970s was crazy. It was like there was these adverts about, you know, not playing too near you know, power lines or being drowned, that were terrifying. And they used to put it on with kids' TV and stuff. And then you had like programs that had like, you know, comedy that you wouldn't see anywhere, you know, anywhere now. And it was all sort of out there. And Doctor Who, of course, and all that kind of stuff. And it all went into that kind of melting pot. And then I became disabled, and it kind of, there was another thing that went in, because whether you like it or not, I maintain that every disabled person automatically is an activist, because you're challenging, you know, if you apply for PIP, you're an activist, because it becomes a political gesture. It becomes, you're overcoming stuff to get support, and it's stuff that's weighted against you as well. The process is actually weighted against you, you know, which is incredibly sad. So I can only sort of challenge that by doing what I do, and changing the world one daft bit of art at a time. And because what I do is like Trojan horse art. People go, oh, look at the colours, that's funny. Oh, he's such a jolly guy, is Jason. And then it hits them, I've got them, because I can unleash my soldiers of activism into, you know, their consciousness. And I've seen people go from laughing and being really sort of jovial about the work to seeing something on the work that makes them cry and has them, you know, gives them a real, you know, sort of real emotional sort of reaction to it. Like I had do not resuscitate badges on my figures, and people saying, what's this DNR badge, Jason? What does it mean? And I told them, because it was the time of COVID, and, you know, 60-odd% of disabled people being absolutely at the forefront of COVID deaths, you know, and do not resuscitate. And so I included that in my work, my jolly work. I included it, you know, to basically remind people and to have a debate with people. And, you know, because I tell you what, in years to come, when they look at what happened in that period, there's going to be some serious questions to be answered, because disabled people and the elderly and, you know, whoever, were thrown under the bus. We were thrown under the bus and we were left, you know. And it's, so you make jolly art, but you can still be angry and keep smiling.
But actually, I think that's such a good way to almost be like, fuck you. It's such, you know, I really like the idea of like enticing people into something that's really like beautiful, and then realizing that actually the message is actually quite ugly. And it's that, like, it's that comparison. And that's like the historic, like the art historian in me is being like, oh my God, like I've got so many questions about like, how do you create your art, and where does that art like come from? And being able to have that ability to be like, I want to make it enticing, but I also need to say something. And all art, like, I don't care what your belief is, where you're from, who you are, all art is political. Like, it literally doesn't matter. Like, I've got a degree in history of art. I could talk about this until the cows come home, but it is all political. And being able to tie that in with, like, obviously I appreciate the disability activism because, like, it's so close to home. And being able to tie the two together, I think, is so important, because I think you're right. I think they're so... we almost try and put like a fluffy spin on what it's like to be disabled in the UK, but actually there are some real fundamental flaws with the system. And everybody enjoys art, right? So everybody thinks they enjoy art. Everybody's like, oh, look at that pretty picture. It's so beautiful. And you're like, look at it again and actually take it in, because there might be something a bit more to behind it. And I love that. I think there's nothing more powerful than like a really colourful, beautiful piece of art that also is actually just like a giant fuck you to the system. I think there's like nothing more important than that. Like, my favourite period of art is Arte Povera. Like, I love it. And my favourite pieces of art are some that have come from the 1960s in Italy, because they literally had nothing. It was like art of the poor people, but they made really beautiful and really like poignant pieces of art with what they had. And it's very, very similar to you. Like, you're making art with the thoughts and the memories that you have, but actually at the same time there's something to be said in it, and I love that. And oh, I get so excited.
Oh, bless me. I mean, so one of my friends said, your work is punk, Jason, and I said, what do you mean? I said, well, yeah, it's about being kind. And I thought, because I said, because punk, forget the spitting and all that kind of stuff, and you know, it was a movement that was about, you know, there wasn't a at the core of it, you know, there was anger and stuff, but there was also this comradeship and kindness and this kind of explosion of creativity and colour, and I like that, because I try and put, you know, that there's anger obviously and there's activism, but I really believe, you know, in kindness. I think that is off as a human thing, this thing that we have. Being kind is one of the most, you know, wonderful things that we can pass on and do for other people, you know. So for instance, I've spent, well, it took me 15 years to become an overnight success. I always joke about that, but I spent those 15 years sort of working with groups of disabled people around the country and mentoring so that they could go on. And one young lad, Jonathan, got his first Arts Council grant last year as a result of, you know, and I went to Japan last year and mentored artists with disability over there. They're having an exhibition at 2021 in Britain, which is a gallery just in North Lincolnshire, which I'm so proud about, you know. My Changing Places sculpture, which is a depiction of the Changing Places toilet movement. Imagine that, a sculpture about going for a poo. But and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. As a result, everywhere that has been shown, there's a Changing Places toilet there now. Yeah. So changing the world a little bit at a time by, you know, making a stand and you know, really engaging with people, not shouting, because shout anybody can shout, any lunatic can. I went to Cambridge at the weekend. There was a guy on the corner of a street with people around him, and he was shouting about immigration and things. And I thought, you know, all that energy that's been wasted on nonsense and kind of hatred, you know, be kind. It's a really good start. It kind of liberates you, you know, and it's cool. Yeah. It's good.
It's so true. It is. It's so true. And actually, like, I love that. But I'm a big believer that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and if we drag people up with us, so like we always put our hand down to bring people up with us, and that's exactly what you're doing in like taking, like, you know, mentoring other people and showing people that you can be a disabled artist, like you can do art and you can be disabled and the two can coexist, because I think so often so many places are inaccessible. And actually I was wondering if you'd had any experiences whilst like entering into the art world that actually it was inaccessible for you to get to places, or was that never really something that happened for you?
It still happens. I've just I won't mention, I'm not gonna name and shame them, but there was a big organization that I attended where I got stuck in a disabled toilet that wasn't a disabled toilet. You know, that still happens. My life revolves around any disabled person who's a, you know, a wheelchair user. We are obsessed with toilets. We are getting to one and being near one and all that kind of stuff. It's like a big issue. I've got stuck in more than I can even begin to count. I've had, you know, talking about inappropriate touching and stuff, I've had people tapping me on the head and saying, "Oh, ain't he lovely?" And I'm saying, you know, fuck off. Don't do that. Don't. Because the great thing about being working class and Northern is I am really gobby and I'm fantastic at swearing. So they only ever do it once. They only ever do it. It's something to do with the flat vowels. It really enables us to swear very eloquently. But yeah, there's also some fantastic organisations. Like when I was really struggling at the start of my career, Shape Arts, bless them, an organisation for artists with disabilities. And I said, look, I don't know what to do. I want to be an artist. What do I do? And because my degree didn't help me, you know. Nearly 30 years ago, we had 15 minutes where they said, right, when you leave college, it might be a bit like this. And that was it. The door was closed. So, but Shape Art said, well, we've got an open exhibition. And why don't you put some work in that? That was the start of it all. In lockdown, Jeff, from one of the guys that works at Shape Arts, rang me every other week to see that I was okay in lockdown, because you can't buy support like that. And because of their support, I went on to go to Qatar and create work at the Museum of Islamic Art, you know, and flying out first class and thinking, bloody hell, I've not done too bad. this is quite nice. So I was reading The Socialist Worker, of course, whilst in first class, you know, singing the red flag. But it's these opportunities that I've had, because there is really good, amazing people out there that are, again, coming from that experience in the 80s, 70s and 80s, you know, these organizations had really bad experiences. You know, that I mean, when I first became disabled, every street corner had a Spastic Society little fiberglass collection thing of a little boy or a little girl in calipers. So you put your money through the forehead. That's how disabled people were depicted. We, you know, that it was. So that song, Spasticus Autisticus, like Ian Drury, absolutely bless him, he wrote that for the International Year of the Disabled. And they said, can you do something else? Because it seems a bit angry. It seems a bit angry. And he said, no, that is it. That's my experience. And that's the experience of, you know, other disabled people that I know. And I do think there's a lot of good people out there. Things need to change. The DDA Act needs a good look in it and bits of it rewriting. The statement, for instance, reasonable adjustment, that causes so many problems, you know. I was in London recently for an exhibition and I wanted to go for a meal. We went to 20 restaurants, all of them unaccessible. 20 in London in the 21st century. And I mean, I want to spend money, you know. I mean, I was hungry. Nando's was the only place I could get in. So for that week, I ate chicken every night.
I mean, I really like Nando, so I'd be quite
happy. I love it.
But it's the frustration.
Yeah,
and it's
choice.
That
yeah.
inaccessibility. And like you said, that lack of choice that actually we're in the 21st century and you 20 separate restaurants, 20 separate venues,
yeah,
and all
yeah.
inaccessible.
Because of reasonable adjustment, they get away with it because of that term, because, oh, we're mm-hmm. we're an old building, we can't do that. You can. Just do it, because we'll come and spend money, and, you know, it's everybody will be happy.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, like, realistically, when we think about it, it doesn't take much to make somewhere accessible. It really does not take much at all. It's a ramp. It's maybe a lift. It's having lowered down bars. It's having maybe lower tables. It's not like you're changing the infrastructure to a degree where it's going to require like new buildings and new poles and new windows and new, like, obviously new doors. It will require that, but it's not unachievable at all, because it's not that hard. It really
yeah,
not.
Yeah. Cinemas have got it. I always use cinemas, like multiplex cinemas, as a really good example of like accessible buildings where nobody realizes they're accessible because everybody's using them. You know, it's really contemporary design, really simple, all on the level usually. You know, although saying that, my local cinema is 20 miles away because I live in the Lincolnshire. I'm from Yorkshire, but I'm doing kind of I'm sort of based in Lincolnshire now. But so everywhere is 20 miles away. So we've been to the cinema and driving 20 miles, get there, and the lift's not working 20 miles back. But because I'm really gobby, because I just made a real fuss of it, so I've got lots of free tickets, but, you know, I shouldn't have to do that because it's upsetting. Yeah. I remember when my kids were young and, dad's off again, you know, like most of their childhoods were like me having a go at somebody because, you know, mm-hmm. the hotel room wasn't accessible. I just want to be like everybody else, really. You know, I'm unbelievably boring in many ways. I'm kind of, you know, but I have this lifestyle that isn't, you know, this.
Yeah.
You know, this. I mean, I'm going to. I've got work in the Venice Biennale later this year, and it's in April. It starts, and it's like the organization.
I've got like tears in my eyes.
Yeah, but it's not bad for there's other things as well which I'm not allowed to talk about, but there's lots of really big things that are happening, and they're really lovely, you know, they're really but I've got to do like loads of organization because I've got I'm really greedy. I've got three major operations as well this year to have
just casually, you know. Not a problem.
Yeah. And that's, you know, because I always joke, Damien Hirst doesn't have to put up with this. Damien Hirst doesn't have to worry. I've never heard him mention, oh, I'm a bit worried about having a poo at this. do you think I'll be able to have a poo when I get to the gallery? Do you think it'll be all accessible, the loo? I've never heard him mention that. But, so it's kind of, I've got this amazing lifestyle and, but it's bloody difficult sometimes. Like, can you imagine going to Venice in a powered wheelchair? So I'm in this really heavy wheelchair, and we're going in June. It starts in April, but I'm going in June, and basically, we're having to book taxis and stuff because it's all on water. So, you know, it's going to be a bit bonkers. But you know what? If I was asked tomorrow to go into space, I'd do it. I would do it. I'd do the Stephen Hawking. I always say when people say I can't do this, I say, well, Stephen Hawking went into space and allegedly had two affairs. If he can do that, and he can't even move or talk, if he can do that, you know, it's like possible. There is it's doing it because it's difficult, and
Yeah.
And you're allowed to moan about it as well if it is difficult.
But actually, that's so important, because I think a lot of people have this idea of like the angry disabled person. And it's not that we're, yes, there are certain things that really upset us and really anger us. And actually, it's very, very justed and very, very valid. But you are allowed to be angry. I think as a society, we've equated like anger to be bad, but actually that anger is a very normal emotion that we have, and we're allowed to express that. And actually, if you don't express it, then that's going to cause you problems like later down the line. So actually, you are allowed to moan about it, and you are allowed to be angry, because if you're not, then nothing really changes.
Absolutely. It's yeah, say it.
Yeah,
what's that
exactly.
expression that you hear on the train? See it, say it. Is that, was it?
Sort
see
it.
Say it. That's it. Yeah, I think that's pretty
see
apt
it,
for
say
life.
It, sort yeah. it.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you, Nando's. Yeah, I'm open for sponsorship. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that would be the dream sponsorship, wouldn't it? Like, get yourself a Nando's black card.
Yeah.
Never have to pay for it ever again.
It paid in buckets of hummus. I think that would be really good.
Oh my gosh, maybe that's your next sculpture.
It's
all payments
the hummus is all. I do talk about hummus a lot. I think in every interview I mention hummus. I think I've got a bit of a thing about it. But and don't get me started about tarum salata. It's it's all different ball game.
So with all of the experiences that you've had throughout life, whether they be good or bad, is there a piece of advice that you would give a younger version of yourself?
Keep the faith, because I struggled so much in my teenage years. And I think, you know, like I said, on reflection, there's no doubt that I had quite serious post-traumatic stress as a result mm-hmm. of the things that happened to me. In the yeah. care system, and you know, and that I was unable to talk about for years, really, you know. Mm-hmm. Keep the faith, mate, because it gets better, you know. And
yeah,
you'll be able to make art about it and sort the fuckers out.
But I love that. Like,
that's it. Yeah,
I love that. I think there's so much, obviously, like, I'm an art girl, right? Like, I love art. If people don't know that about me already, then, like, news. But I think there's so much to be said about being able to, like, portray a message, which is arguably and equally more accessible in an art form or, like, a sculpture or a painting than it is if you're just speaking, because not everybody fully understands what you're saying. Words can get misconstrued and communication can get lost, and we can all pick up on different things from different people. But actually, you give scope to that interpretation when you create art, but actually at the core of what you're doing is there is a message. And I think that is like invaluable, and being able to give that to other people is invaluable as well.
It is, and I'm always a firm believer in, you know, it gets better. It does get better. And yeah, it was tough for me then, but it ultimately got better. It took me 40 odd years for it to get better, mm-hmm. you know, but it did. And you know, it's an ongoing process, but I still connect with him. I believe in, you know, I think memories are like time travel, you know, so I still, mm-hmm. I still kind of connect with that lad lying in the hospital bed and thinking, you know, whatever I was thinking, really, which was, oh, the doctor's just said I'm going to die. You know, it was really, really weird, but I wasn't particularly upset about it. To be honest, the things that happened to me, I wasn't particularly upset about at the time. It just mm-hmm. kind of happened, you know, and, but that's what the kind of care system was like, you know. I just thought, oh, it must be normal to get hit. You know, and
yeah,
you know, I thought that's but you kind of go through it, and it's not right, and it's not proper, and it's, but I call it righteous anger, you know.
You
get me in the end. It always comes full circle, so it all worked out. And yeah, it's but And I kind of remain resolutely committed to being kind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's about.
Yeah, well, I will agree with the person who told you that you were punk, because I think you are pretty punk. I think there's a lot in that, and actually it's kind of great to have that. Upon reflection and upon looking back at times that were maybe a bit more difficult than they are now, is there a positive trait that you have found that you have, and it's really something that you're proud of on reflection?
I am incredibly funny. I think humour is it's all relative, isn't it? But I like making people laugh. I like joy. I like, you know, I'm just as kind of influenced by comedy and kind of humour as I am by, you know, Van Gogh and Frida Kahlo and, you know, all them lot. So it's kind of, it's using humour to kind of deal with bleakness and, it's got me out of some real scrapes. It's got, you know, it's having that kind of sense of, believing in that the light at the end of the tunnel is kind of it gets closer eventually, and you get through it, you know. But I think that kind of resolute commitment to laughing is good.
Yeah, just for my own personal curiosity, who would you say are like your biggest artistic influence?
There's a Guston show, Philip Guston show at the Tate at the moment. If you look at his work and you see the work in the Welcome Collection show, you'll say he's very influenced, is Jason. Frida Kahlo, of course, because she's that famous quote she said, you know, I make art about myself because I'm so often alone. And that's an experience that disabled people have a lot, you know, because or whatever. I kind of love that she, because even though she had disability, she was a right bugger. She was like, you know, into everything, and like, you know, so many lovers. I mean, she had a relationship with Trotsky, and there was the female dancer in Paris. She was just amazing, and like, she was like full of life. She was, she was a diamond. She was, there'd been nobody like her, and she didn't compromise. And every day she put makeup on, even when she was in loads of pain, and painted her spinal corset and stuff, because she was beautiful and, you know, wasn't defined by that disability. And so I love that. I mean, there's so many. I mean, I watch like BBC Four as my, because I'm an old geezer. I like watching BBC Four because they've got really good documentaries on it. But from Hedgehogs to the History of Art, and I mean, I still get excited. I still get that feeling in the pit of my tummy when I look at a Caravaggio, or, you know, I see a Lowry, or I see, you know, Van Gogh. You know, And sort of that sense, Michelangelo, the sculptures of Michelangelo, where you see the veins, and you know, you kind of think, bloody hell, how did a human do that? Mm-hmm. You know, how did this bloke who was like full of contradictions do something that was so beautiful and intense and incredible? And so the history of art weighs heavily on my shoulders, you know. There's so many artists that I go into when I need inspiration, or I want to kind of engage with ideas, or how did that person deal with it? And it's beautiful. It's all there.
Yeah, I can so like understand what you mean when you look at something, you get that feeling in your stomach. Because I find is that I can get quite teary. And it's not because I'm like sad, it's because it brings out so much emotion. And I don't always know what the emotion is, but my eyes just leak. But for me, that's when I know that I really relate to a piece of art. So I went to the immersive Van Gogh experience in London with friends.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And it was amazing. And I just sat there and I just like wasn't sad. I just was like streaming and I was like, but it's incredible. And I was like, and the fact that these images were in someone's head and then they put it on paper and then, you know, they painted it. I love that like cathartic experience. And I just, quite honestly, I wish I was a lot more artistic than I am, because I really ruin a stick man, and it's a real shame because I feel like I'd be very good at art if I could draw.
Oh, bless. Yeah. Well, has it stopped Damien Hirst? Meow. So I've got a thing about Damien Hirst, I think. Yeah.
But everybody's got their Damien. Someone.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their someone.
He's my Moriarty, or maybe I'm his Moriarty. I don't know. We're working on it. Yeah.
With disability, quite often comes the bizarre questions from the general public. And now, these questions can be seemingly meaningless or curious, but I was wondering, is there a particular set of weird questions that you often get surrounding your disability?
There's a lot. One of them was great, actually. It was really funny. I used to go into schools and do lots of talks and workshops and stuff, and mm-hmm. I was in a school in Barnsley where Kez was based, basically, so they had mm-hmm. really broad Yorkshire accents, and it were, and one little lad, I said, any questions? And one little lad said, yeah, ah, yeah, does that wear a catheter? And people are really interested in how I get upstairs and into bed and things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, when I tell them that I've got kids, you can see how. Yeah. Can you draw me a diagram of that, Jason? How that happened?
Does two and two really make four? Like, is that how
yeah,
it works?
Yeah, yeah. It's. You can even now. It's. And like I've said to you, that hotels, accessible rooms have twin beds, mm-hmm. because. Right. Obviously, you know, we don't sleep together and we don't have a life like everybody else does. So, yeah, but the questions, yeah, I've had people just say as an artist as well, I get like, I just wanted to come and say hello. I don't like your work, but yeah, I think your work's heinous and crap. And
yeah. I've had a great time, but I think this is awful.
Yeah, but you're all right, and then pat me on the head and walk off. But so it's, yeah. I think it's, but the disability, I find that people want to tell me stuff, like really personal things as well. Like, oh, he suffered. I'll tell him. I don't bloody want to know about your piles. But if you've got any juicy gossip, tell me that, but keep your ass out of it. I don't want to... Yeah, people just want to come... Because it happens... I was at the Guston exhibition and somebody came up and started telling me very personal things about themselves. Whoa, you know, I'm looking at the painting, mate. Yeah, leave me alone. I don't understand. I'm not empathetic. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Oh. I have to say, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And I love that we've kind of transversed quite a lot of period of time, because it's, again, like as I said earlier, it's nice to see how far we've come. But it's also a reminder that we've still got a long way to go. But we have come somewhere. Like, we're not where we were in the 1980s. And I've loved that. And I want to thank you for having this conversation with me. I only have one final question for you. Yeah. And that is, Jason, are you disabled and proud?
Yeah. I am. I think, yeah. It's taken a long time. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think I am, yes. Resolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on this podcast and sharing your knowledge. I have absolutely loved it. And if people want to see your art, where can they find it?
Oh, blimey. It's at the Bloom Museum in London at the moment. I've got some inflatable sculptures there. I've got a show opening at the Ferrans Gallery in Hull. I've got another show opening at the Usher Gallery in Lincoln. And the Welcome Collection is opening in March. And then I've got the Venice show. So, yeah, it's pretty huge. Yeah.
That's like, that's such an amazing feat to have. Like, the Venice Biennale is fucking incredible.
It is.
Well done you. Yeah. Like, it's so impressive. And thank you for giving up some time of your day to come and chat to me. Like, I've genuinely loved it.
Oh, bless you. It's really lovely to meet you. And I hope our paths cross again in the future.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Disabled and Proud. If you've enjoyed the show, then please give it some love by leaving us a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. It really helps us to reach more and more people each week. Plus, if you've got a particular highlight, then I'd absolutely love to hear it. Tag me on your Insta stories @DisabledandProudPodcast.